This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and welcome to the New Books in Law podcast. I'm joined today by Sida Liu. He is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Toronto and a faculty fellow at the American Bar Foundation. And he, along with his co-author, Terence Halliday, who is co-director at the Center on Law and Globalization, a research professor at the American Bar Foundation, honorary professor at the Australian National University, and an adjunct professor of sociology at Northwestern University. The two of them have written a book that was originally published in 2016 entitled Criminal Defense in China, The Politics of Lawyers at Work. It's part of the Cambridge Studies in Law and Society. Welcome to New Books in Law podcast, Sida.
Thank you, Ian.
So you wrote this book based on, you said in the introduction that it's it took approximately 10 years to put this together. Why did it take so long?
Yes, it did take us 10 years to complete. The reason it took so long is because we started the project in 2005 when I was still a graduate student at the University of Chicago. At that time, we were planning to do a study not just focus on criminal defense lawyers themselves, but also on a more macro topic about China's criminal procedure reform. Because at that time, in the mid-2000s, China was just started the process of revising its criminal procedure law, which was completed by 2012. So at that time, so our first round of fieldwork in 2005, when my co-author Professor Halliday and I went to China, we did interviews in Beijing and in Xi'an. That's where the Terracotta Warriors are. Well, we did more than 20 interviews, mostly with lawmakers and legal scholars, and some lawyers and judges and prosecutors, to hear their advice about and their opinions about the revision of the criminal procedure law. And only in the process of doing that, we started to pay attention and became more and more interested in the problems that criminal defense lawyers face in the criminal process. Because what we realized was that criminal defense lawyers were in a very disadvantaged position in the criminal process. They have a lot of constraints, but not enough rights to carry out even some very basic work like meeting their clients or collecting evidence. So that's why I think from 2007 and 2008, we started to change the focus of our research. We wrote a much bigger proposal, because originally in 2005, we were thinking about just do a paper and as a chapter of a edited volume that Professor Halliday and was editing at that time with Professor Lucien Coppi in France and also Malcolm Feeley at Berkeley on lawyers and political liberalism across the world. But after we finished that chapter, we decided we're going to do a more complex and larger scale project just on focus on criminal defense lawyers in China, because that's where you see from the work of criminal defense lawyers and from the way they mobilize politically, you can see a lot of dynamics of how the Chinese legal system and the state and the society interact. So that's why we wrote a proposal to the National Science Foundation. We were fortunate to get funding support from the foundation, and then to develop into a much longer project. And after that, we did more than 10 rounds of fieldwork, flying to China almost every year until 2015. And we also, there are different focus of our interviews in different rounds. Sometimes we went across the country to talk to ordinary practitioners. Sometimes we stay in Beijing, the capital, to talk to a small group of human rights lawyers repeatedly. And so we changed the focus and the strategy of our research over time. And also the Chinese legal profession also evolved a lot during those 10 years we were doing research from 2005 to 2015. The number of lawyers increased tremendously, almost doubled, I think, during the period. And also there are more and more interesting collective action strategies developed by these lawyers, which we discuss in the book.
So in short, what you're trying to do with your new focus, and this is what became your book, is you're trying to talk about or reveal what is the actual practitioner life like for a Chinese criminal defense lawyer, right?
Yes, that's really one of the focus. We have two main focuses in the book. First is work. Second is politics. So the work part, really, we were just trying to understand how just an ordinary, any criminal defense lawyer in China do her work, and what kind of problems, issues that he or she would face in the everyday work. For example, the difficulties in, you know, in the Chinese legal profession, people call them three difficulties, meaning the difficulties in meeting suspects, the difficulty in collecting evidence, and the difficulties in getting access to the prosecutor's case files. So, I mean, it's just some of the very basic things, the way they do their work, the kind of problems they encounter in their work, and how that reflects the power imbalance between defense lawyers and the much more powerful police, procurators, and the judges in the criminal justice system.
Okay, so in forming your body of evidence, you are interviewing most of these lawyers privately. In other words, they're not going to be revealed by name.
Of course not. Right. That's the basic research ethic. So like all the social science studies, we pass the ethic review. So we when we go to the field site, we get consent from these lawyers. We will interview them. But, you know, like in the United States, a lot of social scientists go out for interviews, record the conversation, right? Keep the recording and transcribe them. And then, you know, there you can use pseudonyms and other things to protect the identity of the informants. In our case, because China is an authoritarian regime, and not all lawyers in China are in danger, but some of the criminal defense lawyers, especially those lawyers who do rights-oriented work, especially human rights-related work, they could be in serious jeopardy just by talking to a foreigner or somebody affiliated with a foreign institution. I'm a Chinese citizen, but I'm affiliated with, at that time, you know, Wisconsin. So so that's very sensitive. So because of that, we never recorded a single interview. We did more than Professor Hallett and I did more than 200 interviews personally ourselves, but we never recorded an interview. What we do is that we will go to a lawyer's office, sometimes in, you know, coffee shops, but mostly in lawyers' offices, and we will sit down with the lawyers, explain our research, and ask for their consent, but we only take notes using a computer. So the way we do it that, is that Professor Halliday will, we design all the questions together. He will ask the question in English. I will ask the same question again in Chinese. And then the lawyers will answer the question. I will translate back into English. And my collaborator, Professor Halliday, will take notes. So this way, we make sure that, you know, we record the conversation fairly precisely, but we do not keep any recording from the interview for their protection. And of course, if you read the book, you will see that we never review the name of any lawyer we interview. We don't even talk about the law firms they're affiliated with.
Right.
We only talk about like which province they're from. Not even which city or, you know, what kind of practice, because just for their protection. This is the ethical requirement for social science research.
So you begin the book with a reference to a case from 2009 that you use as a marker for concerns regarding crackdowns by the Chinese government on lawyers. It's the Li Zhuang case.
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, very precisely.
Okay. And so can you explain that case and why it was important?
Yes. We began the book with that case because from my point of view, the Li Zhuang case really is a watershed event, an important turning point in the history of Chinese lawyers. Because before 2009, when this case happened, there were occasional mobilization of Chinese lawyers politically. You know, they're very brave human rights lawyers like Gao Zhisheng, Chen Guangcheng. There's some lawyers reported in the New York Times and the international media. But most of their actions were isolated and individual. They were not really a large-scale collective action. And also, at the same time, there are some lawyers doing political work, doing human rights work, but they were considered really the marginal members of the legal profession. The vast majority of Chinese lawyers, up until the Li Zhuang case in 2009, they didn't feel like their practice was connected to these human rights lawyers, or in China, we call them Weichuan lawyers. Weichuan means rights protection, basically, you know, those rights-oriented lawyers. They were kind of disconnected from the rest of the profession, and they were heavily repressed by the state. But the Li Zhuang case was a very interesting case because this is a case in which Li Zhuang was a lawyer. He was a senior partner in Kangda Law Firm, which is a very elite law firm in Beijing, in the capital. He is a not the most famous criminal defense lawyer in China, but he's very well known, and he's also quite successful in his career. But he never really was a human rights lawyer or do any politically sensitive work. So in this case, in 2009, he went to Chongqing, which is a city in the southwest, to defend for a private entrepreneur who were arrested and then charged with organized crime activities. There was a background in the political background of the case is that because at that time, Chongqing, the city, was under the rule of Bo Xilai, who used to be the minister of commerce in China. So he really started a campaign, a very harsh campaign against what he calls organized crime, but really the private sector in the city, to arrest a lot of private entrepreneurs and charge them for various kind of criminal activities. So there was a very controversial political campaign going on at that time. Because of that, when Li Zhuang went to Chongqing as to defend for this businessman, very quickly he himself was actually arrested by the police, by the local police, and he was charged for the crime of lawyer perjury. It's Article 306 of the China's criminal law. That makes, if a lawyer fabricate evidence or help induce witnesses to give false testimony, that's a crime called the crime of lawyer's perjury. So Li Zhuang was charged with that crime. And the ironic thing is that Li Zhuang was actually put on trial in the Chongqing court, even before his client, the businessman, was put on trial. So that generated a lot of repercussions in the Chinese legal profession, but also in the broader Chinese public. Because, I mean, Li Zhuang was not the first lawyer who were charged with this crime, lawyer's perjury. Before him, there were already, at least 100, probably more than 100 Chinese lawyers charged with the same crime. And most of them were eventually declared not guilty, but some of them served sentences. And a lot of Chinese lawyers are deeply resentful of this crime, because it almost, you know, in practice became an instrument for the procurators and the police to make revenge on the lawyers who dare to challenge their prosecution and challenge their evidences, because they can always say, oh, my evidence was adopted by the court. So look, the evidence lawyer presented was actually fabricated evidence, so lawyer can be charged with this crime. So there's an abuse of power associated with this crime. And but when Li Zhuang was charged, because of the political background of the case, but also because of his status as a senior partner in the elite Beijing firm, so they generated a lot of attention to the case. And the case itself was also quite dramatic because the defendant, Li Zhuang, he was a lawyer, so he was very defiant in the first trial. There were a lot of courtroom drama going on at that time. But in the second trial, after he was sentenced guilty for the in the first trial, he appealed. And then in the appeal, he actually admitted to his crime. And there were some kind of under the table pre-bargaining going on around that case. But he also, he made a confession. But if you put the first letter of his confession of each paragraph together, it's actually a hidden point. He was saying, I was forced to confess, and then I would definitely appeal when I get out of prison. So there were a lot of drama around that case. So it generated a lot of attention, but also generated a lot of support from other lawyers, because this is the first time. It's almost like a wake-up call. Almost the vast majority, I think, of Chinese lawyers at that time, you know, not only aware of this case, but also realized that if a senior partner of an elite Beijing firm can be just arrested and charged like this, for not even taking the evidence. I mean, there was a lot of procedural problems related to the case. And they realized that if that can happen to Li Zhuang, that can happen to them as well. So in other words, nobody is safe. If, as long as you practice criminal defense, there's always a possibility you will be suffer the same fate. So that's an important turning point, because before that case, as I said, those lawyers who do rights-oriented work, do human rights work, almost disconnected from the rest of the profession. They just do their own thing. They were harshly repressed by the state. But after the Li Zhuang case, you start to see there are a series of cases from 2011 to 2015, when the big crackdown on human rights lawyers happened, which we wrote about in Chapter 7 of the book. During that period, you start to see lawyers all over China coming together, sometimes using social media, have, you know, collective action in court, also on the street and also on the internet, you know, doing things collectively. So this is why the case was a watershed event, and that's why we put it upfront at the in the preface of the book.
And I want to talk about the role of social media in a little bit, but in order to understand some of the historical background before we get to the 2009 period and thereafter, it was striking to go back to the beginning of the Chinese communist regime in 1949. From 1949 through for the next 30 years to 1979, you had noted there is essentially no formal criminal procedural law in China. And so I want to investigate some of that, briefly investigate some of that historical background to bring us up to today. So can you explain this post-1949 period and what happens in 79 and then later in the 1990s?
Yes. So because 1949 was the time the Chinese Communist Party took power, right, from the Nationalists or the KMT, right, which retreated to Taiwan. So after 1949, all the Republican period laws were abolished by the Communist Party. So in other words, all the criminal law, criminal procedure law, and other codes in the Republican period were gone. So in the 1950s, there were some effort by the new regime. They tried to make their own criminal law and criminal procedure law, mostly modeling after the Soviet law, because at that time, the Chinese Communist Party was learning a lot from the Soviet Union. So there was a draft, I think, in the 1950s of the criminal procedure law, but it was only a draft. It never really passed the legislature. And soon after that, of course, there are all kinds of political campaigns and upheavals. For example, the anti-rightist campaign, the Great Leap Forward, and eventually the Cultural Revolution, which lasted from mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, totally devastated China's legal system. During the Cultural Revolution, even courts and bureaucracies and police stations were gone. You know, they all collapsed for a while. Even the military, the army, has to step up to maintain social order. And as for lawyers, lawyers were there in the 1950s until 1957. In the first 8 years of the People's Republic of China, lawyers were permitted, but a lot of the Republican lawyers were reformed, and some of them stopped practice, some of them still practice, and there's some new lawyers studying Soviet law and then became lawyers. But very quickly, within 10 years of the People's Republic of China, in 1957, the government started the anti-rightist campaign, which to attack the so-called rightists in the country. And unfortunately, lawyers as an occupation was labeled rightist. So after 1957, lawyers as a profession were basically abolished. So from 1957 to 1980, when the system of lawyers were revived in China, for more than 20 years, there were no lawyer practicing in China. And during the Cultural Revolution, as I said, there were even the court judicial system collapsed. So after the Cultural Revolution ended in 1976, I think the new leadership, especially after Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978, he and some other central leaders at that time, many of them suffered actually greatly personally during the Cultural Revolution. So they started to reflect on the importance of law and the legal system for the Chinese political system, but also for the economic reform, most importantly. So they decided to rebuild the legal system, including the profession of lawyers. So in that background, in 1979, that was the year China's first criminal procedure law, but also first criminal law, was actually passed. And the year after, 1980, the legal profession was revived. So it was a very interesting history. So from 1949 to 1979, for 30 years, China had no criminal code and no criminal procedure code. So you might be wondering, then how would cases be tried, right? So if somebody commit a crime, somebody murder somebody, or have robbery, all these things, how to decide on these cases? And the answer is mostly these things were decided by the court, or during the Cultural Revolution, even by the police, and without any legal code, mostly based on the interpretations, opinions of the judicial system, within the judicial system, without any code, which is very, I can't say unique, but a very unusual part of the criminal justice history anywhere in the world.
And so were there procedures? This is kind of an aside, and I know it's not the main concern of your book, but during this period prior to 1979, whether it was during the Cultural Revolution or even before in the 50s and 60s, you say it's the police that are the focal point. Is this just essentially ad hoc summary justice without any kind of record keeping, or do they keep records, and are there procedures at all, even if they're not actual formalized rules?
There are very few formalized rules, but it's not like there's no record. I mean, a lot of people died without record. It's true, but I think it depends. If you go to the local level police, there are some places there are fairly detailed record keeping. For example, William Hurst, a professor of political science at Northwestern, actually has written about some of the police cases in Jiangxi province in South China. Actually, you can see that the police was actually keeping fairly detailed records of the period. And as to whether there are kind of standard procedures they follow, I'm actually not entirely sure if there's to what extent they actually follow the same procedures across the country. I think they're probably locally they follow similar procedures, but nationally there were no really uniform procedure law or procedure code.
Well, I'm sure it probably varied from place to place. Okay, so with that historical background in mind, we we normally think of 1979 associated with China as the opening of the market reforms that Deng Xiaoping instituted. But it is not a coincidence that, of course, the legal reforms are happening. So this is really a top-down reform. And you indicated that in the book, you and your co-author indicated that this is essentially a concern for not only economic development, but also for order and having some type of procedure for all types of crimes. And so this really opens the way for experts, meaning lawyers, to play a role in the justice system now, right?
Exactly. So that was the, I think, the when the legal profession was revived in 1980, when the procedural laws were made in 1979, the idea is, as exactly as you said, is to maintain order, but also promote economic development. And for the criminal side, for criminal defense lawyers, is of course more about maintaining order rather than facilitating the economy. So in terms of that, lawyers were revived. But I have to say that it was not until 1996, that's when the first time the criminal procedure law was revised in China. From 1979 to 1996, the law itself gave very little rights, capacities for lawyers to actually to mount a rigorous defense, because until 1999, if you were a criminal defense lawyer in China, for example, in the 80s, and if you defend for criminal defense for a criminal case, you were only given 7 days before the trial to prepare your defense. So in other words, a lawyer can only step into the criminal process 7 days before the trial opened. So imagine how much work you can do in 7 days, right? So mostly, I think in the 1980s, Chinese lawyer who did criminal work, mostly they take very little evidence. They just mostly meet with the defendant, maybe once or a few times, sometimes don't even meet the defendant at all. They will just read the prosecution's case files and then prepare defense for the court argument.
And so in 1996, these are seen as, in one sense, they are reforms. But as you note, many of the what we would think of as abuses by the state still occur even after 1996. These are things like long detentions and torture. And it supposedly strengthened the rights of criminal defendants. But you note that and I was surprised at this, even 70% of trials actually occur without an attorney.
Yeah, that's still the case even today. Today, if you look at the percentage of criminal cases in China with lawyer representation, it's about that percentage. Nobody have the precise number because a lot of cases were not really, the record were not public. But I've seen different scholars study this locally, and mostly the number is, you know, in the range of 20 to 30%, the criminal representation rate. A reason for that, I think, is the precisely, as you said, the rights of lawyers has never been fully extended to the entire criminal process until the 2012 revision, the most recent revision, which is only five or six years ago. So after 1996, what happened is that, because this is the one argument, important argument we made in the book, especially chapter two, we call it the recursivity of legal change. So the idea is that, you know, you cannot expect legal reforms like the revision of the criminal procedure law to happen in a linear fashion. For example, the 79, there's a criminal procedure law. Oh, 96 is a big step forward. And then 2012 is another big step forward. So it always happens in a recursive manner, in the sense that there are always sometimes two step forward, one step back, or one step forward, two step back. So because every round of law reform is a matter of political struggle, you know, among the people with different interests and different power in the process. So take a 1996 procedural law revision as an example. At that time, lawyers actually didn't even participate in lawmaking process. I mean, the National People's Congress held many meetings, symposiums to hear all kinds of expert opinions about the revision, but lawyers, because bar associations were fairly new and weak at that time. So mostly there was a Minister of Public Security, which is the police, the Supreme People's Procuracy, which is the prosecutors, and the Supreme People's Court, and the Minister of Justice, which supposedly to represent the interests of lawyers, but not really. And some legal scholars, they participated in the lobbying process. So of course, there many legal scholars were really allies of lawyers. They want to expand lawyers' rights to make sure that lawyers have the opportunity to fully protect the rights of the defendants. But every proposal they make, they have resistance from the police, from the prosecutors, very, you know, understandably. So a lot of compromises were made in the lawmaking process. To give you a concrete example, I think the first draft of the 1996 criminal procedure law made by a group of scholars at the China University of Political Science and Law, which is a major law school in Beijing, has more than 300 articles. And then the eventual, after all the debates, all the discussions, compromises, the eventual final version of the criminal procedure law in 96 has only 225 articles. So one third of the articles in the scholarly draft were gone. Not because those are bad articles, not because the legal scholar didn't, you know, think them through, but because some of the judicial agencies and law enforcement agencies didn't like some of the articles. So they just took those out. And that, of course, left many ambiguous and indeterminate elements, components in the law itself. Actually, even the crime of lawyer perjury was a result of the compromise, because it was not there in the 80s. Only in 96, the criminal procedure law reform and the 1997 criminal law reform, they added this crime of lawyer's perjury. I think one reason they added that, one of our informants told us, was because the police were really not very happy about lawyers used to have only 7 days to, you know, prepare a defense. Now they have much longer. So because of that, they said, you know, if lawyers can get into the process much earlier, then we should, you know, prevent lawyers from fabricating evidence, from inducing witnesses to give false testimony. So that was the background of this. And that leads to all the lawyer persecution cases, including the Li Zhuang case in 2009.
Right. So with the 1996 reform, what you get is on the one hand, lawyers are given, and their clients, I guess, are also given greater protections. These are formal protections under this criminal law code. But then this, and this is the 1996 law, this section 306, Big Stick 306, as it's colloquially referred to, is the section on lawyers' perjury. And all of a sudden that becomes where the other hand draws back and still allows this leeway on the part of the police to essentially harass and oppress lawyers that are actually trying to do their job under the new rules, right?
Yes, exactly. So, I want to clarify, the Article 306 is in the 1907 criminal law, but it's the same content as the Article 38, I think, in the criminal procedure law in 96. So basically, back-to-back, two articles basically establishes a crime of lawyer's perjury. And because of that, it was very effective, actually. After 97, after this was written into the criminal code, within 5 years, the All China Lawyer Association, which is the equivalent of the American Bar Association here, has some statistics. The first 5 years after 97, after this crime was established, the so-called Big Stick 306, there were already at least 100 lawyers were detained, were sometimes prosecuted, sometimes even sentenced to prison because of this crime, as a police retaliation about lawyers. And some of our informants told us, you know, when the 96 and 97 criminal procedure law, criminal law was first revised, lawyers were very happy. They said, you know, we have more rights. We can actually collect evidence. We can meet suspects. We can do a lot of things, a lot more than before. And the police officers and the procurators, they were nervous. But very soon, you know, within half a year, the moods completely changed, because the police realized if they want to make revenge, retaliate on any lawyers, there's this very powerful tool they can use. Whereas lawyers realized, although they were given all these procedural rights on paper, if they actually want to use it, the risk is huge.
Right. And as one of your interviewees said, and this is a quote from page 42, he says, "We cannot rely on the law only. It is only a piece of paper. We have to rely on a system, but the Chinese system allows torture to exist."
Exactly. So it's really, this is actually one of the fundamental insights of law and society research. Both Professor Han and I are law and society scholars. We really think it's not the law on the books, the black letter law, that makes a difference in the actual practice. It's really you want to understand how lawyers do their work. You know, you have to look at the so-called law in action. In other words, how law actually functions in practice. And how law functions in practice, always there are people involved, and there are people with limited resources, with their own interests, and with different kind of power dynamics. So it's just unfortunate that in the case of the Chinese legal system, lawyers happen to be the less powerful actor in the whole criminal justice system.
Sure. And this point is much easier to make, of course, in an authoritarian
yes.
system. So the what you refer to as kind of an iron triangle of the police, procuracy, and the courts. Now, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the procurate system or procuracy system, can you explain what role that is and how it's different from the Anglo-American system?
The procuratorial system is very common in civil law jurisdictions or the continental law jurisdictions, mostly in continental Europe, East Asia, and part of Latin America. So the procurators are more powerful actors than the prosecutors in the United States or in the Anglo-American system because, for example, in the Chinese system, the procurators not only just do prosecution, they also have a power of supervision. They can supervise the work of the police. They can also supervise the work of the court. So in the 80s, for example, in the 1980s, if you go to a criminal trial in China, you often find the judge and the procurator actually sit side by side up there. And the lawyer actually sit, you know, together with the defendant. So it's really, that shows you the status of the procurator. So it's really not a kind of an equal balance between the criminal defense lawyer and the procurator. So that's one part of it. Another part is that in all the continental law countries, including China, the procuracy actually bear a much larger role of finding out whether or not the criminal suspect and the defendant is guilty. Because if you look at the conviction rate, in China is extremely high. It's probably definitely higher than 99%, probably 99.9%. But if you look at other continental countries like Japan, Japan is probably around 99% conviction rate. If you look at France, is at least 95%. So the reason for that is because in this system, almost the vast majority of cases actually reach the court. There's a very high likelihood that it will be a conviction, it will be a guilty sentence, because before the case reached the court, the police and the procurators already did a lot of investigation, did a lot of inquiry, to make sure that, you know, cases that are actually problematic were screened out of the system. So in that sense, the procuracy in the Chinese criminal justice system, as many other continental justice systems, bears a much bigger responsibility in the criminal process than definitely than the criminal defense lawyer, sometimes even a bigger responsibility than the judge.
But of course, in the Japanese system, you've got the obligation upon the state that if they don't think that the criminal or the defendant, the accused, has actually committed the crime, it's not merely an obligation as in, say, the American system where you've got this prosecutor's obligation to reveal exculpatory evidence. But you're not, as the prosecutor, even supposed to bring the case against the defendant if you have doubts about the crime, right? And that's the, but it would seem to me that Are those same ethical constraints really affecting the procurators in China as they would in Japan?
I think the difference is this. As I said, the reason we call the police, procuracy, and the court iron triangle in China is because in the Chinese system, these three agencies are not independent. Rather, they all under the leadership of the Communist Party, but also under the leadership, more specifically, of a party committee called the Political Legal Committee, which supervise the work of all these three agencies. So that's why supposedly they should check and balance each other's work. As I said, the procuracy should supervise the work of the police, supervise the work of the court. But in actual practice, they almost operate like a factory, like three shops in the same factory. There's even a joke in China, say, if you look at the criminal process in China, the police are the chefs. They cook the dishes. And the procurators, they are the waiters. They bring the dishes to the table, and the judges only eat the dishes. In other words, when the judges see the case file, it's already pretty much cooked. So that's the difference between China and many other continental law jurisdictions like Japan, like France. So because the court, there's very little judicial independence, so the court are not really in the position to declare a defendant innocent or to argue or to make decisions against the prosecution. So that's very rare.
And so to include within the same analogy, the defense attorneys, they also have to eat the dish too, don't they?
Exactly. They were just sitting by the judge eating the same dish that's already cooked. There's very little they can actually put into the dish.
And so I know that one of your concerns and one of your original concerns is political rights and individual liberty in terms of political cases. But it seems to me that this permeates out into all types of criminal defense work, even stuff that's not necessarily very visible or salient in terms of political importance, because if you can bear with me just one moment, on page 51, you quote one of your lawyers that you interview from Shandong Province, and they say, meeting suspects is very difficult. In the investigation phase, usually the lawyer can only meet the suspect once and is not allowed to ask about the content of the case, just telling the suspect some legal rights. In the phase of the procuracy's prosecution, the lawyer can see the case files, but usually only the procedural evidence and materials. Only when the case reaches the trial phase is it possible for the lawyer to touch on the substantive evidence and materials. Moreover, in terms of collecting evidence, the lawyer's rights cannot be guaranteed. So to protect ourselves and to prevent additional problems, lawyers often do not collect evidence. Also, the lawyer's defense opinions are not useful. After the police and procuracy have gone through the case, it is more or less decided, and the role of the lawyer is limited, only providing some opinions on the reduction of the sentence. I, meaning the lawyer that you're interviewing, usually do not collect evidence. Perhaps I only do so in 1% of my cases. When I read that, I was stunned at how seemingly innocuous the defense lawyer's role is, if this is representative of how defense attorneys actually have to practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is very surprising, I think, for many outsiders. But I think for most people familiar with the Chinese criminal justice system, this is very typical. I can't say it's 100% representative, but it's very typical. Because many criminal defense lawyers, not because they're not trying to do their job, they're not good lawyers, it's because they face so much difficulty and risk when they actually go out to collect evidence. Like, they could be charged with this crime of lawyer's perjury, for example. There are also many other obstacles out there. So as a result, precisely to answer your question about the meaning of politics, I think one argument we really want to make in the book is that, to understand lawyers' politics, it's not just to focus on a small group of human rights lawyers doing highly sensitive cases. Of course, these are important cases. These are important lawyers. They're sometimes very brave, doing heroic work. But it's also more important to realize that politics actually lies in everyday work. And if even if you're just an ordinary practitioner, like we have four categories of lawyers. One of them, we call them routine practitioner, which is the majority of criminal defense lawyers. And even for them, I think, you know, in their everyday work, they encounter all these problems. And that also is a source of political mobilization. That's why the cases like the Li Zhuang case in 2009, where you talked about earlier, could generate such a big impact on the entire legal profession, because it is really about everyday work. It's not a politically sensitive case. It's not a human rights case. It's just an ordinary case, a lawyer defending for a businessman, but the lawyer can get into trouble and can face all these problems. So really, the lawyers have different, reactions to this problem. Some lawyer would just hands off, you know, retreat from doing criminal defense work, or just like this Shandong lawyer you just mentioned, would do very little, you know, as a strategy of self-protection. But there are also many other lawyers, they were not happy about it. They will mobilize individually and collectively to try to challenge the arbitrary state power, try to fight for even a little more rights for their own defense.
Now, to bring it up to the current period since 2009 in the Li Zhuang case, it seems to me that one of the unifying concerns, and this is even before Xi Jinping comes into power and his anti-corruption and consolidation of power occurs, you've got the presence of social media and the internet that seems to be a real tool for these lawyers to use. And so can you explain how, I think we're all familiar with how the internet, of course, can allow people to communicate who otherwise would lack any ability to, but how has this been utilized by lawyers in terms of apps and particular websites?
This is a very interesting development. To me, one of the most fascinating developments, if you look at the history of Chinese lawyers, especially the political mobilization of Chinese lawyers, because just in the Li Zhuang case itself, because Li Zhuang, if you read chapter 6 of the book, you will see that he was charged twice, once in 2009, and the trial happened in 2010, and then the second time in 2011. So that was exactly the period when the social media in China started to boom, to become really popular, because before 2010, 2011, a lot of Chinese lawyers use blogs, and they also use online forums, the bulletin board system, online forums. They discuss things, but there are limitations to these kind of forums and blogs, because blogs, by nature, is a very individualistic thing. You know, you post things on your own blog. Other people can comment, but it's not interactive, right? So blog posts. When the Li Zhuang trial first happened, a lot of lawyers posted essays, you know, supporting Li Zhuang, supporting his defense counsel. But they were just articles, essays, just, you know, posted on the internet. People can read, people can comment on. But it didn't lead to any large-scale collective action behind the case. And also, at that time, there were, you know, online forums, people would post comments. But a lot of these forums are, you know, you can use pseudonyms or being anonymous and still post comments. So that also didn't do very much in terms of collective action. But when Li Zhuang was tried the second time, he was charged the second time in 2011. That was exactly the same time when Weibo, which is a Chinese equivalent for Twitter, because Twitter, Facebook, all these foreign social media apps, most of them were banned from China, were blocked. But at the same time, China developed its own equivalents. Weibo is basically the equivalent of Twitter. And it's actually even more popular than Twitter. For example, you know, it's not uncommon, I think, for very active Chinese lawyers on the internet to have 500,000 or even 1 million followers. I mean, one of the Chinese lawyers I know who is doing a lot of public interest work has 30 million followers on Weibo. First, you know, partially because China is a very populous country, but also because Weibo was getting extremely popular from around 2010, 2011 to about 2013, 2014, in that period. So when the Li Zhuang case, he was charged for the second time, Weibo was very popular. So a lot of lawyers actually used Weibo to, it's a Twitter-like social media format. So a platform. So enable lawyers to actually talk to each other, do several things. First, they can distribute information very, very quickly. So if something happened in the case, for example, Li Zhuang was prosecuted or his defense counsel was confirmed, you know, somebody can post a message and then instantly, you know, a lot, thousands or even millions of people can see it. But on the other hand, also it enabled many lawyers from across China, which is a very big country, who didn't know each other, but they all use their real names when they register for Weibo. So they were able to connect and talk to each other on a daily basis and comment on the same case, follow the same people, and follow the same development in the case. So one example is that when the Li Zhuang trial actually opened in 2011, that day there were hundreds of lawyers and law students actually standing in front of the courthouse. They couldn't get in because most Chinese criminal trials, you cannot, a random person cannot just get in. You have to have certain kind of permission to get in. So, but they just, hundreds of people sitting in, standing in front of the courthouse, and including even some lawyers who actually flew from other provinces on their own expenses, just because they saw the case on Weibo, on social media, and then they flew to the site to support a fellow lawyer colleague. So that's something that the social media does. And after the Li Zhuang case, as we wrote about in Chapter 7, you start to see this online mobilization happening. Lawyers started to use the Weibo at that time to organize what they call the so-called the lawyer groups. They were sometimes, well, for example, there's a case in this province. They will post something online, and then very quickly, a group of 10 lawyers or 20 lawyers, and there was one case, even more than 50 lawyers, will fly to the same location. And some lawyers would serve as the defense counsel for the defendants. Other lawyers would standing in front of the courthouse holding signs to protest. Other lawyers would take photos of these things and post them on the social media. So it become extremely effective for a little while. There were a series of cases. They actually were able to generate such a huge public attention and public concern that the court and the police actually compromised. They were willing to make concessions to the lawyers. So that leads to what we call in the book, the lawyers themselves call the diehard lawyering.
And so in addition to the Weibo, you also mentioned a couple of other apps like WeChat and Telegram that allow private group discussions. Is that still true? Are those technical tools still available to avoid surveillance?
They're still available. WeChat and Telegram came later because Weibo was very popular. Right. Until I think about 2014, 2015. But then WeChat almost replaced Weibo for two reasons. I think one reason is that, you know, WeChat is a more powerful app. It does a lot of things. You can not only, you know, chat with others on WeChat, you can buy train tickets, you can do a lot of things. It's kind of I think it's one generation more advanced than Facebook, Twitter, all these things. I mean, it's a fully integrated app. You can do a lot of things on it. So it's gained popularity. But also another reason is because I think by 2013, 2014, the Chinese government already started to be very cautious about Weibo because they realized Weibo got so popular. So it actually generated a lot of problems for the government. It's very easy for not just lawyers, but also petitioners, you know, other kind of people, activists in Chinese society to organize themselves, feminists, for example, labor activists, to organize themselves for social movement. So that became a public security concern. So I think the government made a series of efforts to limit what you can say and what you can do on Weibo. So that leads to the decline of Weibo's popularity. And WeChat, but on the other hand, cannot really replace Weibo because it's not a public platform. It's more like messaging. It's like WhatsApp, like WhatsApp, but more with more functions. So the discussions on WeChat is not like Weibo. Anybody can see them. Only your friends, like Facebook, your friends can see the discussions. You can have group discussions. You can include hundreds of people, but it's not entirely public. So the dynamics became very different. And then very quickly, especially the humorized layers, people who do more sensitive work realize WeChat is not entirely safe because it's a Chinese app, so run by a Chinese company. So the government can easily, if they want to, monitor the WeChat discussions among these lawyers or other activists. So that's why some activists started to use Telegram, the Russian app, and some other apps. And I recently was told by activists in China that even Telegram, they stopped using it, partially because it was, I think Telegram was blocked from China. You have to use a VPN to access it. So they keep changing the apps they use. Now there's some even newer apps I don't even remember they told me that they use. So they have to constantly avoid monitoring and surveillance.
And so in 2015, in the summer, in July, there was a crackdown widespread. Over 200 lawyers, I believe, were detained. And this was in regard to a particular case, I believe. Can you explain the background for the Wang Yu case?
Yeah, Wang Yu case. Yes. So the now people usually call this crackdown the 709 crackdown because it happened in July 9th, 2015. So the background of the case is precisely as I was saying earlier, that by that time, 2013, 2014, this kind of collective action among lawyers using social media became very popular. And then what happened is that some of these diehard lawyers, they call themselves diehard lawyers because they really push the procedure to the limit. They use a lot of performances, performance art to actually to gain attention on social media. So these strategies were started to be used by some human rights activists. So some lawyers doing human rights work, including Wang Yu, this woman, who, spend a lot of their time defending for other activists and very vulnerable population. For example, feminist activists. Wang Yu was the defender for the Feminist Five. Their five feminists were detained by the Chinese authorities in March 2015, I believe. So Wang Yu was their lawyer. And then but Wang Yu and some other human rights lawyers also defend for Falun Gong practitioners, for Christian house churches, church members, and some very sensitive cases from the government's point of view. And they started to use similar strategy in their cases. For example, they would sometimes fly to a place and, orchestrate a hunger strike in front of the courthouse, and then, take photos, post on the social media, sometimes even doing the protest together with petitioners and some other very sensitive population from the government point of view. So because of that, I think that's the background when the July 9th crackdown happened. And the way it happened is that Wang Yu, this female lawyer, on July 8th, 2015, she drove her husband and son to the Beijing Capital Airport because her son was supposed to go to Australia for high school. So she dropped off her husband and son in the airport. She returned to her apartment in Beijing by herself. And then in the middle of the night, some of her friends got a message from her saying, the electricity and the internet in my apartment was cut off. And then, a while later, another message saying that somebody was trying to get into my home. And then all communication with her just went dead. And the next morning, it turned out that, Wang Yu was taken by the police and detained and eventually went through the criminal process. And after that, within a week, there were more than 200 lawyers all over China. It was very well-planned crackdown all over China who used to participate in some of these diehard lawyering activities were taken into questioning by the police. Many of them were taken to questioning, briefly detained, but then released within 24 hours or 48 hours. But there were at least a dozen of them were mostly lawyers doing more politically sensitive cases were detained for a very long time. So some of lawyers were just taken, disappeared for 6 months. And then all of a sudden declare, okay, this lawyer is being criminally charged. And some of lawyers after six months, the next year, 2016, even would put on TV to make televised confessions for their crimes, even before they went through the criminal process. So this, the so-called 709 crackdown was a big blow for the lawyer activism in China, because it was almost like a nuclear attack on the core members of the human rights bar in China. Many of the bravest and most active human rights lawyers became victims of this crackdown. And many of them were sentenced, were released on bail. I believe at least a couple of them were still in the criminal process even today. So that's actually a great source of distress for me and my co-author, Professor Halliday, because that was precisely the time we were finishing the book manuscript, and we interviewed some of these lawyers. I cannot tell you who, because, you know, we have to protect their identities. But, you know, some of these lawyers were our informants. And then as we were finishing the book, we have to watch them, you know, suffer. And as our book came out, I mean, they were being sentenced criminally. And I don't know how I feel about it, because after our book was published, it generated some media attention, including some popular media like New York Times, like the New York Review of Books, but partially because of the suffering of the lawyers that suffered in this crackdown.
Do you know what has happened? At the time you published this, you weren't sure of Wang Yu's fate herself. Do you know what's happened to her since then?
Oh, yes. Since then, now I think she was... She made a televised confession. Basically, she was put on state TV, broadcast across the country, basically apologized for what she did, you know, in these sensitive cases. And then after that, she was released on bail. Which means that she could be arrested again, you know, anytime. And I mean, there's really no period of this bail. And then she used to live in Beijing, but she was not a local resident. Her residency was in Inner Mongolia, her hometown. So after that, she was released. She was kicked out of Beijing. She was sent back to her hometown. And then very little has been heard about her since then. I think she has been either voluntarily kept a low profile, or, you know, being surrounded by state security, she couldn't really make her voice heard. But she did, Wang Yu did win one of the prizes, I think, given by the American Bar Association for her human rights activism around the same time.
Well, you and your co-author began this book with a reference to an event in the 1730s in France, mm-hmm. with regard to a order of barristers, a group of lawyers in Paris, and their strike against some of the way that justice was meted out in the Parisian courts. And you had noted, you quote, that the crown feared an independent little republic at the heart of the state, thereby underlining how important lawyers are in the society, but also how they can pose an organized, articulate threat to an authoritarian regime. And so I want to end with asking you, do you think that that little independent republic was feared on the part of Xi Jinping in 2015, and that nuclear strike, as you describe it, was effective? Are you pessimistic about not only the rights of lawyers and their clients, but also the trends in China today and what that means for the citizenry? Or are you optimistic?
I am not entirely pessimistic. Of course, it was heartbroken, you know, when things like the July 9th crackdown happened. But on the other hand, I mean, this is precisely the reason we started the book. Of course, when we started the book, this crackdown already happened, but we wasn't sure about its consequences. We started the book with a what happened in France under the old regime, precisely because we wanted the readers of the book to think about it and to realize that what's happening in today's China is not unique to China. Because if you look at the comparative history of the legal profession across the world, you see very similar struggles of lawyers against all kinds of authoritarian regimes. You know, in Europe, in Latin America, in other parts of East Asia, in South Korea, in Taiwan, for example, not so long ago. And some of these struggles were successful. Some of these struggles were not. But nevertheless, you'll always find lawyers fighting against arbitrary state power. Not all lawyers would do that, but there's always a critical mass of lawyers would do that. Because fundamentally, this is there are two reasons I'm not entirely pessimistic. The first reason is that lawyers are not accountants. This is very important because there's always the political side in the legal profession. You know, that's part of their mission. You know, lawyers always do their work between market and state. Some lawyers serve the market, serve the economy. Other lawyers will, you know, protect rights and then fight against arbitrary state power. So this is just the nature of the legal profession. And the second reason I'm not being entirely pessimistic is because if you look at the demography of the Chinese legal profession, it's not totally on the government side. Because as I mentioned, just in the process of researching and writing this book, the 10 years from 2005 to 2015, in 2005, China probably had about 120 or 130,000 lawyers. And by 2015, China had almost 300,000 lawyers. It more than doubled. So if you think about it, during the period, even today is the same. Every year, there are at least 20,000, sometimes 30,000 new lawyers joining the Chinese bar. And let's do a very conservative estimate. Let's say 1% of these new lawyers every year will turn political, become political activists. That's, you know, at least 200 or 300 people. And let's imagine half of them were disbarred or put to prison by the government. There's still at least 100 lawyers left. And that's more than the total number of human rights lawyers in China 10 years ago. So in other words, there will always be, although, as I said, there's this big blow, almost a nuclear attack on the core of the lawyer activism in China 2 or 3 years ago under Xi Jinping. But if you look at the long term, I think there will be always be new blood coming into the profession pursuing similar causes. And even if they cannot, in the short term, do human rights work as they did 5 years ago because the political environment has turned so hostile, they can still pursue activism in some gray areas like feminism, like labor rights, like environmentalism. You know, there are a lot, like LGBT rights more recently. There are a lot of other areas that's not as sensitive as human rights, but can actually allow lawyers some space and some liberty to pursue their mobilization and fight against the authoritarian regime. So I think in the short term, there will be a lot of difficulties, but I'm actually on the more optimistic side in the long term.
The book is Criminal Defense in China, The Politics of Lawyers at Work. We've been joined today by Sada Liu, who co-authored the book with Terrence Halliday. Sada, thank you for joining us on New Books in Law podcast.
Thank you, Ian, for the opportunity.